Water is very precious to everybody, not only to Navajos or white men or anybody. The Great Spirit have put the water there for us to all share it, to use it. Not one person takes over the whole water.
We've been listening to Sarah Natani, a Navajo elder who grew up in the Colorado River watershed. For the lore of the land, this is Jack Loeffler. On Watersheds as Commons, we'll visit the watershed of the Colorado River, a 244,000 square mile expanse of landscape that encompasses much of the arid southwestern United States. The Colorado River system is comprised of several rivers, including the Green River, with headwaters in the Wind River Range in Wyoming, the San Juan River, whose headwaters spring forth in the San Juan Mountains east of Pagosa Springs, Colorado, and the Colorado River itself, with headwaters on the western aspect of the Continental Divide in the Rocky Mountains. Other rivers, including the Escalante, Paria Virgin, Little Colorado, Bill Williams, and Gila Rivers, contribute to the flow of the main stem of the Colorado River. Areas of Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada, California, and Arizona lie within the greater Colorado River watershed. If John Wesley Powell, who mapped the watersheds of the American West, had had his way in the latter decades of the 19th century, each of the many watersheds of the American West would be governed largely from within as individual commonwealths. Instead, the West was divided into states separated by ephemeral geopolitical boundaries as we know them today. If Powell's vision had been recognized, water in the West would be viewed in an entirely different light. Former Arizona Congressman and Secretary of the Interior Stuart Udall tells us something of the Colorado River.
You need a geographical perspective to really study the Colorado River. It has ended up as the most regulated, the most governed by detailed laws and so on. It is sort of fascinating to me that the Colorado River has ended up historically as being the one most controversial, most regulated by law, and in another aspect, because Southern California is not part of the river basin. That's unique in the sense that the main benefit of the river historically has been California.
The concept of manifest destiny entered American consciousness in the first half of the 19th century, a concept that strongly forwarded the notion that American Easterners, largely of European descent, had the divine right to westward expansion, to displace entire Native American cultures, hence to plunder this vast landscape for natural resources, for economic gain, with which to fuel the Industrial Revolution. Thus, economic growth for its own sake became central to the American cultural paradigm. William DeBuise tells us how Eastern entrepreneurs intent on turning California's lowland desert into irrigated fields had inadvertently replumbed the lower Colorado River.
Essentially, the California Development Company, in the process of developing the burning desert that they rechristened Imperial Valley, had been having a hell of a lot of trouble getting water to the valley, because in the cheap and hurried way they built their main irrigation canal that would bring water from the Colorado River to the Salton Sink, that first effort at building the canal kept silting up. And so, especially when the water was low, as it was in the winter, which was the most crucial growing time in that desert, they couldn't get enough water down the canal actually to get to the valley. As an expedient, they simply made a shortcut between a bend of the canal and the Colorado River and just dug an open ditch between those two. And they put no headgate in that they could close to shut the flow of water off if they ever had to. They thought, well, we've got time because the Colorado River won't flood in the wintertime. Well, sure enough, it flooded in the wintertime and just burst through this open gap. And at that time, geologically, the Colorado, having oscillated back and forth its delta, had been over on the east side of the delta for a long time. And geologically, it was time for it to start moving west. Well, here was the great opportunity an open door, a heavy flow of water, and boom, it went. And essentially, the river adopted the irrigation canal as its main channel. And what then ensued was a kind of apocalyptic experience for the Imperial Valley as the river flooded and flooded and flooded with repeated storms. And it followed in the spring again with snowmelt. And for 2 years, a kind of Humpty Dumpty story was played out with all the king's horses and all the king's men trying to put the river back again. And they couldn't do it for 2 years until finally, with all the resources of the Southern Pacific Railroad put at the disposal of a really crack team of engineers, the gap was finally closed and the river was constrained within its old channel. In the aftermath of this, there was the Salton Sea created with all this 2 years of the greater part of the flow of the Colorado River going into the Salton Sink. And really, there was also a new way of thinking about what people in the United States wanted to do about the Colorado River. In a sense, the reverberations of that great flood that filled the Salton Sink shook their way into the creation of the hydraulic society that we have down there today. They led, in a sense, directly, although there were other strains joining this line, but they led to the construction of Boulder, now Hoover Dam, and they led to the California Aqueduct, and they led to the All-American Canal. They led to the plumbing of the Colorado River.
John Wesley Powell died in 1902, the same year that the Reclamation Act was passed that would result in major irrigation projects to be carried out throughout the American West. Floyd Dominey was appointed as Commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation in 1959 and was instrumental in establishing irrigation districts throughout the West. Here, he speaks of the Reclamation Act.
Reclamation Act itself speaks for what it would do. It was recognition on the part of Congress that you couldn't have a lot of people living in the 17 Western states unless you managed the water. The Western rivers were fairly erratic. As a matter of fact, the Colorado River is one of the most predictably erratic rivers in the world. In a dry year, it flows less than 6 million acre feet in 12 months. And in the extreme wet years, like 1983 and 84, it flowed over 30 million acre feet in 12 months. Now, obviously, if your development is limited by the low flow years, you have very little capacity for people's needs. So the first thing you have to do is to regulate the river by huge storage projects that gives you the carryover storage from the wet years into the dry. Immediately after the Project Act was passed in 1902, all the Western states wanted projects immediately, of course. Some of the early ones were outstandingly successful, like the Salt River Project in Arizona, Rio Grande Project in Texas and New Mexico, the North Platte Project in Wyoming and Nebraska. But every one of the states had a project, and the Bureau of Reclamation, without any hydrology, there was no water flow records on the rivers, there was no soil surveys to ascertain the productivity of the soils, but they went to work anyhow and started these projects. And it was a trial and error, of course. Many of the early projects were not successful, at least financially successful.
The Salt River Project, in my view, was not only one of the pioneering Western irrigation projects, large scale, but one of the most successful. That dam was completed in 1913. The Salt River Project is an irrigation project. They divided the land and that huge farming area near Mesa, Arizona, and the surrounding area. The farms fed off the canals that came out of the Roosevelt Dam and even on into Phoenix itself and Glendale. Those huge canals were taking this water, and so these were very productive farms. Well, Phoenix has ended up doing, the Phoenix metropolitan area, doing what Southern California did. Most of the farms, the land was more valuable for developing subdivisions And this enormous growth of Phoenix trying to be another Los Angeles, the farmers, it was so attractive. They sold out and they tore down the citrus groves and the cotton fields. And you see now this huge glob of urban sprawl. But that was one of the most successful irrigation projects. They also developed hydroelectric power, and it transformed the Phoenix area, the Salt River Project.
In 1922, representatives of the seven states privy to the Colorado River was gathered near Santa Fe, New Mexico, to determine apportionment of the Colorado River between them. The meeting was presided over by Herbert Hoover, then Secretary of Commerce. Stuart Udall contended that the Santa Fe-Colorado River Compact of 1922 led to events that enabled Californians to develop Colorado River water well in advance of the other six states.
Herbert Hoover served them well. I've never understood why he was there. He was, in effect, California's agent in putting this through. They wanted an agreement that would enable them to go to Congress and build Boulder Dam. That was a kind of forced marriage. It ended up with this strange thing that never happened in other basins, of each state being allocated a certain amount of water. This was purely arbitrary. There was no rational basis for it. Hoover, I'm sure, exerted pressure that they had to have an agreement. That led, of course, to the construction of Boulder Dam. And that enormous project went forward in the depths of the Great Depression. This again showed the political power that Southern California was exerting, and the economic power, because it got the electric power companies involved. And this was, in essence, a California project. It wasn't anything beneficial to the basin, and the water, other than that, flowing down the river to the delta and flowing to the few irrigation districts like Imperial, huge users of water, the key water, rather good quality water, was going to Southern California through an aqueduct.
Scholar Norris Hundley, author of The Great Thirst, spoke of major inadequacies inherent in the Compact of 1922.
The other thing to keep in mind about the Compact is that it reflects its time in being an ethnocentric document. The Indians weren't invited to participate, nor was there any consideration of giving them a share of the water. Hoover said, we don't want to put a quote-unquote wild Indian provision in here, create a problem for ourselves. Mexico asked to have representation. Prior to this time, and would go on for another two decades, Mexico had been negotiating with the United States over rights to Colorado River water and to water of the Rio Grande. The compact negotiators said no to inviting Mexicans. We don't want to have the Mexicans here. Everyone suspected there would someday be a treaty. The basins would share that Mexican burden, as they called it. But other than that, nothing was said.
The Colorado River Compact of 1922 resulted in conceiving of the Colorado River as a two-basin system, the upper basin and the lower basin, the dividing line being set at Lee's Ferry, upstream from the Grand Canyon. From 1916 through 1920, the river yielded a very high rate of flow of between 17 million to 18 million acre-feet of water per year. Roughly speaking, 3 acre-feet is the equivalent of nearly 1 million gallons of water. It was determined that the two basins would be allocated 7.5 million acre-feet apiece. The upper basin states of Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico would divide their waters between them. In the lower basin, California was apportioned 4.6 million acre-feet, Arizona 2.8 million acre-feet, and Nevada but 300,000 acre-feet. Arizona contended that it was short-shrifted and refused to sign the compact, resulting in a water war between California and Arizona that lasted for 4 decades. The Supreme Court ultimately resolved the dispute. Arizona was granted all of their in-state tributarial flow to the Colorado, plus their original 2.8 million acre-feet. But Arizona's water rights remain junior to California's, so that California gets first water from the river in a low-yield year. Also, the upper basin states are charged to deliver 7.5 million acre-feet to the lower basin per year, or 75 million acre-feet, over a 10-year period. In order for the upper basin states to be able to guarantee water to the lower basin, the Colorado River Storage Project Act was passed in 1956 that resulted in construction of the Glen Canyon Dam, just upstream from Lee's Ferry, and flooding of Glen Canyon with Lake Powell.
What the Santa Fe Compact did is make a what could have been a simple solution, a complex solution that had problems all the way down the line.
California had its great projects with the Hoover Dam, the California Aqueduct, and the All-American Canal that transports water to irrigate the Imperial Valley and other agricultural areas, and also provides water to several cities in Southern California, including Los Angeles. After the Supreme Court decision in 1963, Arizona was poised for its own great project, the Central Arizona Project, that resulted in pumping water from the Colorado River up and over a range to be transported by lined canal to Central Arizona, ostensibly to provide water for agriculture. Again, Stuart Udall.
The early concepts, I'm talking about the 40s and early 50s when they first developed the Central Arizona Project, which Arizona congressmen and senators wanted, the model was the Salt River Project of 1913. And we told Congress, I testified many times, Secretary of Interior, that this was going to be based on the success of the Salt River Project, and the water being brought in would be used for farming. That was the primary use that we had in mind. Well, by the time the project was finished, it was so costly the farmers couldn't afford the water. And the water primary use now is for urban use. And it may end up rescuing Tucson, which has grown too far and too fast.
To pump water 336 miles from the lower Colorado River to the central valleys of Arizona would require an enormous amount of electricity. Originally, two hydroelectric dams were to be constructed, one at either end of the Grand Canyon. This caught the attention of river runner Martin Litton, who wrote about this for the Los Angeles Times. Litton and David Brower, then president of the Sierra Club, took up the cause, and ultimately the dams were defeated. How then to generate electricity for the Central Arizona Project? Attorney Charles Wilkinson, author of Fire on the Plateau, tells us more.
You've got to have the CAP. And that was not only non-negotiable, but non-discussable. That means you had to have another power source. And the, quote, logical place, as indisputable really as it originally was simply to dam the Grand Canyon, now the simple solution was the great world-class coal deposit under Black Mesa. Black Mesa had obstacles that should have been as obvious and as important as the distance and the gradient of the CAP itself, but they weren't. What the obstacles should have been but weren't were that this is the Hopis' ancestral land, a deeply traditional tribe in one of the most remote areas in the lower 48, living in their own way and deeply connected to Black Mesa. It is a very complicated matter to scour out the coal bed and create one of the largest, if not the largest, coal mining facility in the world, and then send the coal to two different power plants. One, the Mojave over in Nevada, would be used for electricity generally. The coal would be shipped also north to Page, where Navajo Generating Station would be built to provide the electricity for the CAP, which was far to the south, but with the power grid that had been built up during the big buildup, that was of no consequence. That, quote, simple formula, use Black Mesa coal, ship it north to Navajo Generating Station, use that electricity for the CAP, should have been profoundly complicated for us, because you're tearing up Hopi land, you're tearing up old villages, sacred sites. You're then sending it to a coal-fired power plant that was going to foul the skies, the Hopi skies, and everyone else's skies. It got even more tangled and even more dark. because of the way that the Hopi lease with Peabody Coal was negotiated.
Coal was to be strip mined, and some would be slurried 273 miles west to the Mojave Generating Station in water pumped from the aquifer beneath Black Mesa. This aquifer fed springs that had provided the Hopi Indians with water for at least 50 generations. The rest of the coal was transported via railway across the Caipito Plateau to power the Navajo Generating Station by the shores of Lake Powell behind Glen Canyon Dam. John Boyden ostensibly served the Progressive Hopi Tribal Council. He also quietly worked in behalf of the Peabody Coal Company in direct conflict of interest. Today, Black Mesa Coal still provides energy to power the Central Arizona Project. Lillian Hill is a young traditional Hopi woman who has lived with the specter of the rape of Black Mesa her entire life.
I was just really hurt for a long time, you know, that these things were happening, that Peabody was digging in the ground and taking this water, and, you know, how we couldn't even plant anymore because it was too dry, and we just had to have a lot of faith, you know, more faith in ourselves. And even today, you know, it's just been really hard and difficult, even, you know, when you're taking part in ceremonies, to know that these things are happening, and it affects you. It affects the way that you pray. It affects the way that you believe. And so for me, I feel like these tribal governments who have signed these agreements, they're going against everything that we believe in as Hopi, and they're affecting the ceremonies because people, a lot of the old people are really hurt by that, and they're really angry. And that's kind of how I feel right now. I feel real hurt and I feel angry. I'm just trying to find a way that I can be of service to try to end these things from continuing, especially with the knowledge that we have now of how coal is processed and how it goes to power plants and how they put out all this pollution, and people who don't even live here, they're affected by that. And that's what the elders, the Hopis, knew all along, and the traditional people, they knew those things, and that's why they were so opposed to that type of activity. And today it's really hard for us as young people to act and to continue those ways, because a lot of our people have forgotten those teachings, those traditional teachings, and to try to hold those things holy and to hold them and honor them, it's really difficult. But I just feel like Peabody shouldn't have been there in the first place, and that they're not welcome there, and they don't have a right to be doing what they're doing, because it's affecting a lot of our ways, and it's affecting us in the way that we pray too. So I don't agree with what they're doing there.
Today, the Southwest is home to the fastest-growing urban populations in the United States. 30 million people now rely on the Colorado River water in the lower basin. Author William DeBuise has conducted a major research project involving the effects of global warming and climate change on the watersheds of the American Southwest.
The lower basin of the Colorado is operating at an annual deficit of between 1.2 and 1.3 million acre feet. That's an enormous amount of water. The allocation for the lower basin is only 7.5 million acre feet, so it's a big percentage of that. And basically the reason that's happening is none of the states in the lower basin budgets its water consumption for evaporation, transmission losses, the share of their apportionment that goes to Mexico for our treaty obligation, things like that. They expect that to come out of, or have been expecting and have been getting away with, that coming out of surplus years. Well, since about 1999, we haven't been having surplus years. We've been having the opposite. And Lake Mead's been dropping and dropping and dropping. And we're approaching now taking some serious measures to deal with these annual deficits. In fact, in the last couple of years, we've had pretty good winters, pretty good snowfall in the Colorado Basin. But we haven't had good runoff years. What's going on? Well, it's probably climate change. We've got warmer temperatures, and that means more evaporation. so that for the same bang of precipitation, you get a lot less buck of storable water. We're beginning to experience the pressures of this change in the environment on our water resources. And the climate change models forecast reductions in surface stream flow of 10 to 30% over base periods. Let's say the base period is the average coming into the 1980s for the previous 20, 30 years. I think that's how they have measured it. So when you're already in a deficit position and your income is dropping 10 to 30%, I mean, if this were a bank, we would declare it insolvent. The regulators would need to come in and take it over. That's what we might see on the Colorado. The Rio Grande is maybe not in as extreme a condition, but it's still heavily allocated, probably over-allocated. There are big questions about how much water various entities like the Middle Rio Grande Conservancy District actually use and how much they're actually entitled to. Astonishingly enough, even after the better part of a century, there are still big, big ambiguities about who owns what and who's entitled to what. Indian water rights remain on both rivers, big, big question marks. And so if we were a really well-organized, foresightful society, we would clean up all this business as we approach the future. But we don't seem to be doing that. I liken climate change to a set of rapids on a river. You know, and here we are in the boat of society, and we're going to run the equivalent of lava falls in the Grand Canyon. Well, you can't control a lot of things down there in the rapids, but you can control one thing, and that is your point of entry. It's the location, the angle of your boat, your velocity, you know? Point, angle, velocity. You can control those things. And that's how you run a rapid. You've got to get the right point of entry, the right angle, the right speed, etc. Are we doing that? Doesn't look like it. And so we're going to have a much more haphazard run through the rapids. We're going to be bouncing off the rocks, bouncing off the walls. We're going to be taking on a lot of froth. We'll get turned around, probably. And God only knows how we're going to come out the other end.
On Watersheds as Commons, we've heard the voices of Stuart Udall, Floyd Dominey, William DeBuis, Norris Huntley, Charles Wilkinson, Sarah Natani, and Lillian Hill. Theme music was provided by Carl Bernstein. Production of Watersheds as Commons is funded by the Christensen Fund and the New Mexico Humanities Council and is produced in the studios of the Loeffler Oral History Archive in association with KUNM Community Public Radio in Albuquerque, New Mexico. For free access to other Lore of the Land programming, including our earlier radio series Moving Waters, the Colorado River in the West, please visit our website at www.loreoftheland.org. For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Loeffler. Thank you for listening.